Hello, teens on the internet. You're listening to Jeff from Snack Point Charlie on WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, home of the hits.
Wayfarm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wayfarm and our radio station, WGXC, operate and broadcast. The Mohicans named themselves the people of the waters that are never still, following their arrival along the Mohicanitta, the great ebb tide river also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For further information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit Mohican.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Kyle of Athens, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
This is Mitch McConnell when I'm up in the Catskills to go hunt bear and visit my friends in the Greene County Legislature. I always tune into WGXC. I love that weird show, the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour, but it's not on very often with a bunch of crazy Yankees up there. Where is that station again? Oh, now, remember, it's at 90.7 FM on the dial in my Lexus. I wish we had something like that in Kentucky. Don't forget to vote, y'all.
This is Ginger Radio Hour on WGXC 90.7 FM in Acre. I'm Justin Maiman. Today on Ginger Radio Hour, music and bears. Bears and music. We'll be talking with tremendous journalist named Gloria Dickey, who has written the book about bears around the world. There's only 8 species left. We're going to talk so much more about that. But first, a set list of music to get us in the mood. We're going to start with the track Dallas from Blue Lake, a music project that unfolded in the woods.
Thank you. Earth will be there. Earth will be there to catch us when we fall. Earth will be there. Earth will be there. Whether it's the water or the land, Earth will be there. Like outstretched hands to catch us when we fall. Please, children, remember this. Who gonna catch her? Who gonna catch her? Who gonna catch her when you fall? No matter how far, who gonna catch? Who gonna catch? Gonna catch you when you fall. Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch you when you fall? Earth will be there. Earth will be there.
Space, I'm falling, I'm coming. I think about my grandmother's hands, deep in red earth. I think about the strength of my grandmother's hands, holding it all, the weight of it all. I'm coming. How soft is the landing I'm coming? Is it soft like cotton? Is it soft like new plantations? How soft is the landing I'm coming? I am thinking about my grandmother's hands. Deep, deep, deep in Alabama, dirt. Deep, deep, the winds of change returning, returning. I think about my grandmother's heart, the weight of it all.
Grandfather's not there. Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch you when you fall? Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch her? Who's gonna catch her? When we fall. Who's gonna catch us? Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch you? Who's gonna catch you? When we fall.
got that right. Wishful thinking, kind of lit the glass. Your high school was a guess, but don't let it be the end of you.
Thank you. feel like.
That was Let's Fall in Love Tonight from Louis Blue. I think that set list got us in the perfect headspace for an extended conversation with Gloria Dickey. Gloria Dickey's an environmental journalist. Her new book is called Eight Bears. It's really unusual that there are only eight bear species left in the world when you compare it to other animals. And Gloria and I speak about that and much, much more. We focus especially on the black bear, which of course here in the Catskills is a bear near and dear to our heart. Our hearts. All of our hearts. Here's me and Gloria Dickey talking about eight bears.
Yeah, I think I had kind of a vision from the get-go of moving through the book bear by bear and using each bear to explore kind of a modern environmental issue, whether it was habitat loss or climate change or poaching and trafficking. I hadn't really thought as much perhaps about like the bear-human relationships of old going in, you know, the fact that we used to think that bears were our closest relative really surprised me, that prior to, you know, DNA testing where we could figure out that we're closer with primates, people thought it was bears because, yeah, we could walk on hind legs and so could bears at times. I think the fact that bears are so prolific in kind of North American and European cultures surprised me compared to the relative absence from, you know, places in South America and parts of Asia outside of the panda bear. Well, and also to that point, the fact that we actually, you know, the panda was believed to be a mythical animal until like, you know, the early 20th century. So those sorts of things really popped out at me. Those are some random bear facts. But I think, you know, I had a good grasp on the environmental issues, but perhaps the cultural aspect surprised me.
I mean, speaking of random bear facts, I told this to everybody as soon as I read it. The idea that a bear print is basically a size men's 11 shoe print.
Yeah.
I never forget that. And and now it has me looking for prints everywhere, especially when I'm on trails.
Well, I had an experience once. I was hiking in Boulder, Colorado, and I was walking across this rock in the early morning, and I looked down and it looked like there was a wet, you know, human footprint. And then I was like, wait a minute, that's like a wet, you know, fairly fresh bear print. And it looks exactly like a human's foot.
That is tremendous. So you mentioned the panda bear, and I want to come, like, I have to come clean here. I have such a reverence for all animals and all things, great and small, but I've always had a real problem with panda bears. And I think it's partly because they're kind of it's almost too easy for them. Like, they've been held in this reverence. And as I grew up, I remember being kind of overwhelmed by all of the news stories about, you know, the latest panda bear coming to a zoo in America. And so for some reason, they just ended up on this list of animals that I was kind of, I don't know, I'd seen too much of them.
I think you're not alone. I think pandas are actually kind of polarizing because, as you said, like, more money has been spent on panda conservation than like any other species. So for people who, you know, they're not an underdog, right? They are an underdog, but in the global conservation realm, they're very much, you know, the 1%.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it. And so I did really appreciate that I got to spend some time and your book helped to kind of alleviate the stereotypes that I had thrown on them. But to that point, like, what if I put you on the spot and you have to start ranking the bears now that you've gone through the 8 species? Where do you, like, who lands on top for you?
In terms of like a favoritism, like a preference for you? Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked, like, what is my favorite bear question quite a bit, and my kind of response is typically the polar bear. I don't know if I can like fully say why that is. I think part of it is like a pity vote, because I think the polar bears are perhaps the least likely to persist. But they're also just super cool. Like, they live on the sea ice. It's super hard for them. You know, most animals could not survive in that kind of habitat, and yet these kind of like powerhouses of a bear, you know, they go out and they eat seals for half the year in this really harsh environment. My second favorite bear? I don't know. I find sun bears very cute and interesting. You know, they're like the tiniest of the bears. They have really long tongues. They are found in tropical lowland forests in Asia. They're like a very unbear-like animal. You know, people will look up in trees and think maybe they're looking at an orangutan, and then it's like, oh, it's actually a sun bear. I think that's kind of cool. But then I think maybe after that, it's kind of a wash in terms of preference. I think I like them all equally after that.
That's fair. Ranking is hard, of course. But I do, I agree with it. I didn't know anything about sun bear. I had seen photographs of it. But I think if you had quizzed me before I read the book, I wouldn't have said, oh, that's a sun bear.
Right. How many bears did you know of before?
Oh, that's a great question. I knew of exactly, I would say, 4. I knew grizzly, black, polar bear, and then my least favorite, the panda bear.
Right. Well, and grizzly is a subspecies of brown bear. That's my
right. I'm sorry. And
my,
yeah,
my judgment. That's what most people know, though. Like, when I've done this kind of straw poll with people all over, and everyone knows the exact same 4 bears. Some of them think that pandas aren't bears, but for the most part, I get the exact same response. I would say the 5th most known bear is probably the sun bear. Some people have heard of the sun bear. But the other 3, like, no one tends to mention, which are spectacled bear in the Andes, the moon bear, and the sloth bear in India, just in case it helps to get those names out early.
Well, and maybe the moon bear wins as the best name. I mean, that's a tremendous name for a bear.
It is, but then it always gets mixed up with the sun bear, right? Like, it's, you know, they're trying to compare them, but people mix them up. So it's maybe not the smartest.
Bad branding. Huh. I mean, I'm very partial to black bears because I grew up in the Northeast, and we have plenty of them. And where I am now in the Catskills has a pretty stable population of about 2,000 black bears.
Wow.
And I have been lucky enough to see a couple, one on a trail once. For the people who listen to my show, that really is the majority of their experiences with black bears in and around the Catskills and Hudson Valley.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the bear that most people have experience with, right? It's kind of, it is the backyard bear, and it was, you know, that was the first bear that I ever saw, you know, I guess in the wild, in quotation marks, because it was also kind of in a city. But you know, what you're describing, this bear coming in and seeing more bears around, is certainly a trend that's happening across the U.S. You know, when I kind of start the book in Colorado almost a decade ago. And you know, bears coming into town then, and kind of being worried about them. But then I learned, you know, American black bears are the most prolific of the eight remaining bear species. There's nearly a million of them between Canada and the US, and they're actually considered to be, you know, doing pretty well, and they're making a lot of comebacks across different states. Whereas, you know, when bear hunting was a bit more popular, some of those populations had gone down quite a bit, but now we're seeing them kind of return with a vengeance, if you will.
Well, and it becomes, I mean, this is a through line, as you say, you start the book this way, but it's a through line with all of the eight bears is that trying to figure out how a bear and a human population can kind of live, I don't know what the best word is, like,
Coexist or
yeah, coexist, I guess, but on like a seesaw level, right? Because it there's clearly times at which it's working better for one species or the other.
Totally. Yeah, it's kind of you know, bears are turning up in unexpected places, and then they shrink back and they come forward. It's this kind of ebb and flow of bears in some ways. And I think, you know, the American black bear is maybe the more interesting bear in some ways because of its behavior. Like it's typically, you know, as I'm sure like you kind of experience it's kind of like a raccoon in terms of its temperament in some ways. Like you know, you see a bear and you're probably not overly worried that it's in your backyard. It's kind of cool, you pull out your iPhone. But there's always like that kind of like what if underlying backyard bear. You know, we do see American black bears attack and kill people occasionally, but typically, you know, 90% of the time they seem like fun and cute, and then there's that other 10% that's a bit more you know, scary.
Can you talk a little bit about this point you make in the book when you learn from someone that there are some black bears in I believe it was Lake Tahoe that are no longer hibernating and what it means?
Yeah, that was really interesting. So bears typically in North America, American black bears and brown bears, you know, they will den down come November, December to try and, you know, get through the winter when there's not a lot of food available. But what scientists are seeing in places like Lake Tahoe, where you have kind of this abundance of human food or garbage available year round, is that the bears are actually staying up because they can just keep eating all winter long. And coupled with warmer temperatures because of climate change in some places, we're seeing bears, you know, drastically reduce or stop hibernating altogether. You know, in places like Yellowstone, you know, sometimes you get kind of early wake up bear warnings because the bears are out of hibernation earlier than expected. But I think in Lake Tahoe, it was the case that, you know, some bears just, they were, you know, kind of sleeping under people's porches during the day, but they were always up and about and, you know, breaking into dumpsters or in some cases gas stations to grab bags of chips and candy or even bakeries.
So what does it mean? Is it, I don't want to get in too much detail, but it's not necessarily the worst thing that's going to happen to a black bear, right? If it's no longer hibernating.
Yeah, that was a question that I had was, you know, what happens to the bear? You know, how beneficial is hibernation to like the bear's physical body? Does it need to hibernate? And, you know, what scientists told me was that, you know, there's lots of bears of species that actually don't hibernate at all. Those that live around the equator, you know, spectacled bears, a lot of the bears in Asia, they don't hibernate. So there's not really any damage that happens to them at like a physiological level. But when bears are staying up longer, they have more time to get into trouble and to die, whether it's being hit by cars or being killed by wildlife managers. You know, bears don't typically die when they're hibernating, but they do die when they're out and about with us.
Yeah, that really stuck with me. It's, you know, being in a den is going to be the most safe place on the earth for them.
Exactly. I guess unless you're in, there's certain states that allow people to kill bears in their dens now. But outside of that, it definitely, you know, you're kind of tucked away from the world and you're safe. So.
I don't know if I'm going to get the term right, but I think it's the same. So I recently interviewed somebody who's an expert in woodpeckers, and we were specifically talking about the pileated or the pileated, depending on where you live. And And he was describing all woodpeckers, but this woodpecker especially, as a keystone species. And I feel like either that term or a different term came up in your book about how bears are a similar species. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of an umbrella species and sometimes use keystone species. I think people have asked me a lot about, you know, like what kind of roles do bears play in the ecosystem? And, you know, the easiest answer is because they're a large mammal, you know, they require large chunks of habitat. So if you're trying to protect bears, you're protecting more habitat, which helps protect all the species that kind of come underneath the bear in a food chain. And then there's some more concrete examples of the benefits that bears have. We've seen, for example, like in British Columbia and Alaska, when those bears that feed on salmon drag the salmon carcasses into the forest, they eat them, the salmons decompose, and they fertilize these ancient cedar trees. So they're kind of, you know, connecting the river with the woods. We also know that bears, you know, spread around seeds in their scat. You know, they're kind of tremendous gardeners, if you will, in that sense too. But at the same time, I think, you know, people have asked me a lot of questions about, you know, kind of, you know, do bears keep elk populations down? Do they impact deer? And do they kind of keep numbers in check? They don't play like the same role that like a wolf would in the environment. But certainly in terms of like maybe those more herbivorous kind of impacts, they have that keystone effect. And other people also refer to them as a cultural keystone species, which is that they're just so iconic, you know, in indigenous stories that they, you know, kind of, I guess, mean a lot in that sense, even though it's maybe not an ecosystem sense.
Is there a simple way to talk a little bit about bears and climate change? And maybe the simplest way is to talk specifically about the polar bear, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly kind of the number one, not just the bear that's being threatened by climate change, but kind of the icon of climate change, right? Yeah, and the other one too is also the spectacled bear in the Andes, but I can start with the polar bear. So the polar bear, of course, depends on sea ice to feed. It kind of stakes out above seal breathing holes, waits for a blubbery meal to pop up, and then it strikes. And that's kind of how they've evolved, and they're adapted, you know, very specifically to that kind of environment. Of course, with climate change, we're seeing, you know, record low sea ice year after year. You know, summer sea ice could be gone as early as 2035, scientists think. You know, the multi-year sea ice is thinning. It's not as firm as it used to be. It's disappearing. And so polar bear numbers right now are kind of doing okay. You know, there were, I think, around 20,000 across 19 different populations in the Arctic. But they're heading towards this very steep cliff, whereas once the ice is gone, you know, so is the polar bear, and you can't save polar bears on the ground because you have to stop climate change for them to preserve their habitat. So it's kind of has the most bleak future, I suppose, of any bear. And then you also have the spectacled bear, which lives in the cloud forests of the Andes, and they're kind of facing a similar threat from climate change because they live in this really unique ecosystem, which is kind of, people describe it as like a fairy tale forest with plants, you know, growing on top of other plants, really dense forest, and they're eating all of this stuff. And they don't seem to like to use the lower elevations, like where the Amazon is. They like to be kind of in that middle sweet spot where the clouds float through and they water those plants and the bears are in there. But with climate change, the point where the mountains and clouds intersect is shifting upslope, which is kind of leaving the bear and its habitat high and dry below that line. And so there's concern as well that they're losing, or they will lose, a bunch of habitat to climate change.
It's a hard pivot to make from that, which is like fairly depressing. But I think your book does it a really, like your book has a hopeful tone to it. And I'm curious if that was a lot of effort in order to like turn it into a hopeful tone of, you know, rather than maybe a bleak one.
Well, I appreciate you saying that it has a hopeful tone. I wasn't quite sure if it did or not. And some people have been kind of like, you know, it's a very gloomy book. And I think as an environmental journalist, you know, it's pretty much impossible to write anything that's truthful without having a bit of a gloomy or bleak tone to it. And I think, you know, but we are at this kind of inflection point where, and not just for bears, but for all of the natural world, where kind of what we do, you know, in the next decade and the choices that we make and what we protect is kind of at a pivotal moment for which of these species will persist. And, you know, with bears, I think that we have a lot of success stories. You know, I think the panda bear, even though its numbers are low and some people might have a bit of a grudge against it, we have seen, you know, we have seen it's kind of an inspiring story to the extent, like, the length to which China has gone to save a single species. And if only we could do the same for so many other threatened species, then, you know, the world would be a better place for it. But we are seeing that, you know, in the case of the moon bears and sun bears. I went to bile farms, which is part of traditional Chinese medicine. And, you know, we have seen countries like Vietnam outlaw, and they're trying to move all of these bile bears into sanctuary as fast as possible. So we're seeing progress, you know, in small ways. I think, again, when it's those really big issues like stopping and reversing the impacts of climate change, you know, that's quite difficult for species like the polar bear. But we can make gains in other areas. And indeed, we have in the past, you know, the grizzly bear in the lower 48 is another success story of conservation.
I mean, it really helps when a, like in your China example, and now I'm thinking of the U.S. either with the grizzly bear or with, you know, the American eagle. The bald eagle, which right now in my head is just the American eagle. You know, if you get the power of a federal government around something like that, and they've decided that that's going to be, you know, an emblem of a country, that really helps.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's a really good point that we've seen kind of the same, you know, the American eagle or the Chinese panda, if you will, that we've seen kind of that robust action when it comes to those species. And I think it's really interesting, too, to think of grizzly bear recovery because, you know, in some ways it's maybe easier to conserve and bring back the panda from the brink of extinction because it's kind of this useless roly-poly animal that doesn't really pose a threat to people. I think it's a whole other thing to try and bring back an animal that's capable of killing you, and indeed sometimes does. You know, we saw recently a hiker in Yellowstone was killed, or a jogger in Yellowstone was killed by a grizzly bear. So that takes a whole, it kind of takes like the whole human tolerance debate to another level when you're willing to restore, a man-eater. It's probably not kind of the kosher word these days, but it's interesting to think about that humans did that.
Yeah, and it makes me think a little bit, and I'm sure you've written about this or covered it over the years, like the wolf is a different kind of debate. And the wolf obviously does not really attack humans in that same way, but because it does attack people's livestock.
Yeah.
It becomes... Sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say, no, I really love thinking about like the wolf versus bear intersection culturally in the US. And I get into that a little bit in the book because it always stood out to me as this kind of, yeah, I guess irony in a way, like why do people dislike wolves so much? Because yeah, wolves don't really kill people. And yet, you know, when I met people who had such, harsh feelings towards wolves, they were typically pretty amenable to grizzly bears, and they really like talking about bears, and they didn't have that same anger towards them that they did wolves, even though on a personal level in some ways bears pose a greater threat. And I was trying to think about why that was.
Yeah, I don't have a quick or easy answer, but I lived in Minnesota for years, and the wolf is a little more accepted there than it is, you know, in the West, in places like Montana and Wyoming and places where it was reintroduced or had to be reintroduced.
Yeah. I think part of it is like if the wolf, you know, they perceive the wolf to have been gone for a long time, so it's seen as not being a natural part of the ecosystem, even though it used to be there, whereas bears, you know, to some extent have always kind of been around. That's kind of the maybe obvious explanation. The other explanation is that, you know, the stories that we tell about bears versus wolves are far more kind towards bears. You know, we have the big bad wolf in The Three Little Pigs and Red Riding Hood, but kind of the most famous piece of bear folklore is Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And in that story, Goldilocks is kind of the villain. Like the bears are kind of the victim of the human who breaks into their house, not the other way around. I mean, I think out of any kind of group of animals, the bear, at least in our cultures, is like the most iconic. I mean, I'm Canadian, and when I was researching the book, I found that at one point it was considered to name Canada Ursalia instead, meaning place of bears. So it is so deeply entrenched culturally, and, you know, again, indigenous stories that kind of, you know, kind of posit that humans and bears are shapeshifters and move between forms. I think, you know, I guess beavers get, you know, they get some love, but I don't know if it's maybe to the exact same extent as bears do in our society.
No, definitely not. I think bears are at the top. So you've given me a lot of your time, and I appreciate it. I'm wondering if there's something that I've completely missed, or something that, just like a through line or a talking point that you want to make sure that you share that I've completely missed today.
I think you got the gist. I might, one thing I kind of like to highlight when I speak to people at bears, people sometimes ask me like how smart is a bear? How intelligent are bears? Given that we've, you know, talked about how close, you know, bears and humans kind of have been historically. And that was something that kind of surprised me. You know, I tried to look into, you know, I guess, ursine intelligence, and they're very smart. You know, they're smarter than gorillas on certain tasks. There's a guy out in the woods of New Hampshire, Ben Killam. I don't know if you've heard of him, who kind of had all these somewhat orphaned black bears around his property, and he, you know, did the mirror test with them, which is basically like, can an animal recognize itself in a mirror? And, you know, he purported through his studies that they could. Not that many animals have been able to pass the mirror test, so that's pretty significant if that's the case. You know, they use tools. Polar bears have been found to use tools to hunt. So I think, like, recognizing, I guess, you know, sometimes, I mean, it shouldn't be that way, but sometimes humans tend to see more value in animals they perceive to be intelligent. And so I just like to highlight that, yeah, bears are pretty smart, and they're probably pretty aware of, you know, what we have done to them, for better or for worse.
I'm glad you brought that up. One of the things I really enjoyed in your book was when you point out that in like a cross species test of, you know, quote unquote smartness, the bears, like, they had that like stick-to-itiveness, persistence that like helped them get through a task or a puzzle in order to get to food. And one of the other species, the example was a cat, which pretty quickly gave up and didn't care.
Yeah, I think it's that curiosity and that persistence, which is like why people like bears, right? Like when, you know, we were talking before about all the videos of bears, you know, in pools or in hammocks, like you see that kind of spark of curiosity that I think humans recognize ourselves in with bears. Like they're just behaviorally complex in a way that I think we don't necessarily see the same with maybe big cats or some of those other animals. And that's kind of, you know, it delights us to see bears acting like ourselves or acting like clumsy little children, you know, playing in the backyard. Yeah,
of course, we're incredibly simple. Myself especially, and anytime I can see something that like I feel like I can relate to in an animal or a bird, that really helps.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it, you know, it, especially for species that are facing extinction, I think, you know, that could be a critical distinction for their path forward if we're able to, you know, recognize a part of ourselves in bears.
Cold ice on my tongue makes it sway towards oblivion. Sweet the vista, the portal view. On my way to black and blue, on my way to black and blue, how sweet the vista, the portal view. I couldn't believe it till tonight, this whole place made of light. I made myself home. Don't know what's wrong, don't know what's right. I belong here with animals might. And the taste of water on my tongue, it was cool and it was good. I never knew it before. And I love you so much more. I love you so much more. Never knew it before. I love you so much more. I love you so much more. I never knew it before. I love you so much more. I love you so much more. I never knew it before. I love you so much more. I love you so much more. I never knew it before. And the taste of water on my tongue, on my way towards oblivion. The taste of water on my tongue, on my way towards
thank you.
For listening to Ginger Radio Hour today. Go find Gloria's book, Eight Bears, and be careful with the bears. Remember, the human-bear relationship is a very complicated thing. It's a seesaw, as we talked about today. As always, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for listening to Ginger Radio Hour right here on WGXC 90.7 FM Community Radio.
Snow will be a blinding sight to see as it hide. Lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. Lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find the butterfly within. Caterpillar shed its skin to find